ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you ever wondered why everyone's worried about microplastics?
Or what the best time of day is to exercise?
And why are some people left-handed, Tegan?
Well, the best people are. Anyway, we've got the show for you. It's called What's That Rash?
Where we answer the health questions everyone's asking. I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan.
And I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And we promise we're not here to sell you supplements.
It is surprisingly hard to find podcast hosts who aren't.
But we do want you to search for What's That Rash in the ABC Listen app.
And we might answer your question next.
A man sits in a prison cell, furious to be there. He doesn't see himself as a criminal, says he's broken no law. But this isn't his first time behind bars.
He's in his single cell. He's expected to wear a prison uniform. He has very limited association with his rebel colleagues, a number of whom are there.
The man is an Irish rebel. The year is 1917, and he's been fighting British rule, and they keep locking him up for it.
And he gives seditious speeches. And within a couple of months, he's rearrested because of his seditious speech, and he's back in prison, this time in Mountjoy, which is the biggest prison in Dublin City.
What the British don't realise is that this prisoner is about to fight back in the only way he can, by refusing to eat. And that decision will transform jailed rebels into martyrs, weaken Britain's grip on Ireland, and push a revolution to boiling point.
Men would die, martyrs would be created, propaganda would thrive, and the revolutionary movement would grow.
I'm Mark Fennell, and this is a saga of food, pride, and prison that would reshape the future of Ireland, the British Empire, and no one saw it coming. So, we are at the turn of the 20th century, and Ireland is a nation in flux. It's still part of the United Kingdom, but there's this massive cultural revival happening. Irish language, sport, literature, identity, a lot of it's been reinvigorated. And alongside that, you've got some new democratic ideas, and it's fueling a growing and very deeply felt push for Irish independence.
So Ireland is an integral part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland at the start of the 20th century. And Ireland followed in really out of security concerns. There had been a rebellion in Ireland in the late 18th century, and the new British elite were afraid that, you know, Ireland would be a backdoor for Britain's enemies, such as the French. But nationalism is really growing in the second half of the 19th century, and it's becoming stronger and stronger and stronger.
So this is Dr. Will Murphy.
And I'm a historian based in Dublin at Dublin City University. My work on the Irish Revolution and prisons in particular.
Now, in Ireland at this particular moment, there's a debate raging about whether Ireland should be ruled by Britain, whether the Irish should rule themselves completely, full independence, or go kind of half-half, which is known as home rule.
The dominant variety in the late 19th century is kind of moderate nationalism. Their representatives are regularly elected to the British Parliament in Westminster. And what they're seeking is limited autonomy for Ireland, a kind of home rule inside the Union, a bit like Scotland has today. In contrast, there are those who are very radical. They want complete separation from the United Kingdom. They want a completely independent Ireland. And very often they want that to take the form of a republic. And I suppose the last group to mention on the island is there are unionists who are attached to the Union and they want that to remain. And, you know, they're also very vociferous and they're organising, but they're definitely in a minority at the beginning of the 20th century.
Now, in case you're not massively au fait with Irish history, essentially, Ireland's colonial relationship with England goes back to the Middle Ages, from the late 12th century.
We don't want to go through what the nationalists would describe as the 800 years of oppression, okay?
Fine, let's not do the whole eight centuries. Just know this, generation after generation saw bloody wars, uprising, crackdowns as the Irish resisted the English and later British rule. By the early 20th century, which is where our story sits, those tensions are dialed right up. And a big reason is this debate behind home rule.
And that provokes a lot of conflict on the island of Ireland between nationalists and unionists, and it also provokes conflict between Irish nationalists and unionists in England, okay? And it looks like there might be a civil war in Ireland around this question of whether Home Rule will be introduced or not. But this whole process is interrupted by the outbreak of the First World War. So the war sort of introduces a break in this sort of looming crisis.
The First World War kind of hits pause on the Home Rule movement, but it really fuels this idea of radical nationalism.
So they move into the space which has been left behind by this pause in the political process. And most famously, they organize a rebellion or a rising at Easter 1916, where a very small number of them conduct a significant event. They try to seize control of the center of Dublin, and they hold it for a week. And there's an armed conflict between those rebels and the British army in the centre of Dublin, and much of the centre of the city centre is destroyed.
The Easter Rising becomes a pivotal moment in Irish history. Irish Republicans, they seize key sites across Dublin, they proclaim an independent republic, and they try to force an end to British rule. It begins on Easter Monday in 1916, and it only lasts 6 days. And when it's over, the British authorities decide they are going to crush this movement once and for all. The response is swift, and it is brutal.
What the state does, the British government does in the context of the war, is it represses very heavily. That includes executing the leaders of the rising, using emergency wartime legislation, but also imprisoning very large numbers of the rebels and other people who hadn't been involved but had been suspected as rebels.
That heavy-handed response backfires. Across Ireland, there is outrage. The executions are seen not as justice, but as overkill, violent, unnecessary, deeply unjust. Instead of crushing dissent, Britain has just poured fuel on it.
And so now they provoke a sort of nationalist response from people who were not necessarily sympathetic with the rebels, but suddenly they see the repression and they become more sympathetic to the rebels.
So the harder the British push, the more Irish nationalism hardens. And then London's answer is essentially to double down. They start rounding people up, throwing them in prison, hoping that that will stop the tide.
After the rising, you have mass imprisonment. They're put into regular prisons, those spaces, very often single cells, designed to ensure isolation, to separate people away from their associates outside. They're very useful to crack down on political movements, as well as to crack down on the criminal class. So in all sorts of ways, they're hoping they can use the prison to stymie the radical movements.
But what the British don't see coming is that they have just gathered their opponents in one place. Stripped of their freedom, yes, but they're now together. They are organising, they are talking, and slowly the prison itself starts to become a space of opportunity.
They become a new site into which they can bring the struggle. If they're clever, they can use the prisons as a sort of another theatre of the conflict and bring their desire to undermine the institutions of the state right into the middle of one of those institutions, the prison, a critical institution for the criminal justice system. And they can, if they're clever, make it very hard for the authorities to, you know, make these useful and to weaponize them.
And there is one prisoner in particular whose treatment becomes a flashpoint for insurrection. His name is Thomas Ashe.
So he's a local leader. And then it's the 1916 Rising which brings him to prominence. He leads a group of Irish volunteers to attack a police barracks, and they kill 11 policemen in the course of the Rising. After the Rising, he's arrested, he's court-martialed, he's sentenced to death. The sentence of death is commuted. He's given a sentence of penal servitude for life.
But after a year, he is a free man again.
The government decides that it's the clever or opportune thing to do to release the prisoners, not to provoke Irish nationalism any further. So he's released after a year. And then he goes back to his nationalist organising, and he's got more status. So he's now the president of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, that revolutionary organisation. And he starts to go about the country reorganising the Irish volunteers, the paramilitary organisation, trying to put it back together after the Rising. And he gives seditious speeches. And within a couple of months, he's rearrested because of his seditious speech. And he's back in prison, this time in Mountjoy, which is the biggest prison in Dublin City.
What's life like for him inside that prison?
He's experiencing broadly the prison regime that most prisoners would experience. He's in his single cell. He's expected to wear a prison uniform. He has very limited association with his rebel colleagues, a number of whom are there, but he has to associate with ordinary prisoners. He has the prison diet. He has the prison work. And he and his fellow radicals are not at all happy about this. So they set about, in the days and weeks after his imprisonment, of organizing themselves together and demanding a separate status and demanding to be treated better. Sometimes they say they're demanding political prisoner status. Sometimes they say they're demanding prisoner of war status. But they're very clear they want to be treated better than the ordinary prisoner, and they want to be held separately from the ordinary prisoners, because they were motivated not by self-interest or greed or whatever. They were motivated by the higher calling, which was Irish nationalism, and therefore they deserve a different kind of treatment.
The thing is, if Ash and the others are recognised as political prisoners, it has an effect on what happens outside those walls. It gives their struggle a kind of legitimacy.
But on the other hand, the thing that they're really, really interested in is just finding an excuse to open a conflict with the prison authorities and with the government more broadly. So they're issuing a set of demands, which in part they're hoping the state does not immediately accede to, and then that will allow them to organise protests inside the prison and attract attention and attract sympathy and drive the movement further.
So they have these demands. What's the lever they pull to try and get these demands seen to?
So the lever they turn to is hunger strike. Why did they turn to hunger strike? Well, in part because anyone who was politically aware in Ireland or Britain in the early 20th century would be aware of it as a tactic or a strategy. The suffragettes had used it widely in the years before the First World War as they pursued their demand for the right of women to vote. And they had used it very successfully to, you know, draw attention to their claims and to interrupt the government's attempts to suppress them.
Interestingly, some of the prisoners are hesitant to adopt the plan, but simply because it's associated with the suffragettes. And in their eyes, that makes it a tactic borrowed from women rather than the actions of soldiers.
And they want to project themselves as manly rebels. And they're somewhat wary of adopting a tactic that might be seen as a womanly or a female tactic. But what happens is, at first, individuals adopt it. And it looks like it's quite successful. They're very quickly released from prison by the authorities who are afraid that the prisoners will die and afraid of the publicity. And so soon it's not just one or two prisoners are adopting it, but now whole groups can see the potential advantages of it. And particularly this group in Mountjoy in the late summer of 1917.
And that is when the state strikes back, right? Because their response to these hunger strikes is kind of startling, isn't it?
So, I mean, they've got various choices, obviously. You know, they could release the prisoners, they could grant the demands, but they don't. So what they do is they turn to a tactic they had used in the case of the suffragettes as well, and they would describe it as artificially feeding. The prisoners would very definitely describe it as forcibly feeding or force feeding the prisoners.
Within a few days of the hunger strike starting, medical officers take prisoners into the hospital to be force-fed.
They will place the individual prisoner in a padded chair, which is reclining. They will strap them into the chair. They will ask them if they will voluntarily take food. If they won't voluntarily take food and they're persisting with a hunger strike, they will introduce a tube into their stomach. They will either do it by putting the tube down through their mouth and throat, or alternatively, they put the tube down through the prisoner's nose and down into the stomach that way. And the idea is to introduce some nutrients. Very often it's a mixture of milk and eggs that's literally being poured down into the stomach of the prisoner via the tube.
Can you imagine how horrific that would have been to endure? And it's not a simple procedure to perform either. Forcing a tube through the nose or the mouth down into the stomach, it is risky and precise work. You have to know exactly what you're doing. Which brings us back to Thomas Ash and what happened when he was strapped into that chair.
It went very badly wrong very quickly. He goes on hunger strike on the 20th of September and he's first force-fed on the 23rd of September. Initially, he's force-fed by an experienced prison doctor, but there are nearly 40 prisoners in hunger strike and the prison doctor can't do them all. So they bring in an inexperienced doctor from the locality to assist him. He's had just minimal training. He's been shown that day how this procedure works. And straight away, something goes wrong. Immediately after the force feeding, Ash becomes very ill. It's apparent he, he has had a heart attack. He's transferred to the nearby Mater Hospital, where he has another heart attack, and he dies that evening. And it's very likely what's happened is that in putting the tube down through his nose, the doctor, who's called Dr. Lowe, has put the tube down into his lungs rather than into his stomach. And so the liquid has gone into Ash's lungs, and this has prompted the heart attack.
This is an absolute disaster. One of the key figures of the Easter Rising is dead. He's just 32 years old. And from a British perspective, this is the worst possible outcome because Thomas Ashe has died in their custody.
The last thing they want is a nationalist martyr. And immediately they recognise they've got a terrible problem. There's outrage in the city, which had already been sort of transfixed by the hunger strike. You know, there had been protest meetings organised. The newspapers were covering the hunger strike widely. And now the news gets out that Ashe is dead.
The name of the doctor involved quickly becomes public. His house is surrounded, his family is threatened, and huge crowds gather at the hospital desperate to see Ash's body.
And then the body is transferred to City Hall, the seat of city governance, which happens to be right beside Dublin Castle, which is the seat of British power in Dublin. And they now bring the crowds marching through for days to see the body and to express their anger at what's happened and to demonstrate their desire to see Irish independence and so on. And the nationalists, the radical nationalists, see a wonderful opportunity, you know, in Ash's death, and they organise an enormous political funeral.
Tens of thousands of people pour onto the streets for Thomas Ashe's funeral.
And there's a huge procession out to Glasnevin Cemetery, kind of 3 miles long. And the volunteers in their uniforms, which are apparently illegal, are on the street marshalling this funeral procession. And when they get to Glasnevin and the body is lowered into the grave, there's a revolutionary speech by Michael Collins, a leader of the revolutionary movement, and there's military demonstrations with shots being fired over the grave. So they take this opportunity and they sort of project it through taking control of the public space and by bringing crowds onto the street.
The thing that blows my mind about this is they've somehow, by trying to keep these prisoners alive, by trying to kind of minimise what's going on, they have inadvertently created a huge moment in the movement for Irish independence. It's a really phenomenal turning point in history.
Yeah, I mean, it's an enormous own goal. And, you know, it's not the only, but it's one of the events in these years, 1917, 1918, which feeds organizations like the Irish Volunteers, but also promotes Sinn Féin, the political wing of radical Irish nationalism. And it's one of the things that shifts ordinary nationalist voters away from the traditional moderate Home Rule Party and over to Sinn Féin. John Dillon, who was one of the leaders of the Irish Party, said about Ashe that he did more through dying for the radical movement than he would have done for 1,000 years if he'd continued to live.
It is a staggering thought, really, that in death, Thomas Ashe advanced the cause of Irish independence far more than he ever could have in life. A month later, an inquest into his death begins, runs for about 11 days. And with each passing session, a prominent Irish nationalist barrister relentlessly presses the authorities. A guy by the name of Tim Healy,
who describes himself as the barrister for the family of the martyr, driving the authorities from pillar to post, exposing their mismanagement of the organisation, exposing their apparent maltreatment of the prisoners. And the inquest jury returns, unsurprisingly, a result which blames the prison authorities for Ashe's death.
In light of this, the authorities decide that they're no longer going to force feed prisoners.
It's too dangerous. They really don't want to create another martyr in the circumstances in which they created Ashe. What they try and do is they try and create a regime which will be acceptable to the prisoners, effectively. Okay, so they grant some of their demand.
But the prisoners aren't satisfied. Doesn't take them long to accuse the government of walking back any of those promises. And in protest, the prisoners stop eating again.
So over several months, you get a whole series of hunger strikes. And group after group after group of prisoners get released, to the point where in early 1918, prison really has been rendered useless to the authorities. Their police are arresting nationalist activists all over the country. They're putting them through the business of trial. They're sending them to prisons. And 2 or 3 days later, they're out in the streets, marching down the village where they'd been from, waving at the police and taunting them and so on.
The prison that was meant to contain the movement and then suppress it has now become a very blunt instrument. It's not deterring anyone anymore. So the British do shift tactics. They concede that political prisoner status they were asking for, but they say, if you go on hunger strike again, no, we're not going to force feed you. We're just going to let you starve. And this is where a man by the name of Terence McSweeney enters the story.
So Terence McSweeney is from County Cork, and he's sort of a middle-class nationalist activist and intellectual. By the summer of 1920, he's the Lord Mayor of Cork. Okay, so he has quite significant status.
And by the way, McSweeney became the Mayor of Cork because his predecessor was assassinated by police in 1920.
And that indicates to you that by 1919, 1920, Ireland has become a site of significant violence. The government is using prisons more and more and more.
And it's around this time that the British authorities do something incredibly weird. Instead of keeping Terence McSweeney as a prisoner in Ireland, they take him to London.
One of the ways to try and minimise prison protest in Ireland, they think, is to take the key leaders out of Ireland and separate them away from the other prisoners.
But believe it or not, that does not work either. In fact, the protests, even across the water, they continue. And now that McSweeney is on hunger strike in London, one of the biggest capitals of the world, the story goes global.
And indeed, the British press in London, who are reporting what's happening widely to a British audience and shifting British public opinion, but also then you have the international press who are projecting out to America, to France, to Britain, to Australia, New Zealand, and so on. And the world, it becomes really interested in this conflict between the authorities and McSweeney in particular. The sort of lone potential martyr in London is very attractive. He becomes the way that people tell the story of the hunger strike.
So we've had two incidences here, and we're zooming in on a handful of stories of a larger policy, but two stories where attempts to control, attempts to stymie these particular characters has backfired spectacularly. McSweeney in London, what happens to him in the end?
So he eventually dies on hunger strike after 74 days. He dies on finally having embarked on his hunger strike in August. He dies on the 25th of October, 1920. The press is kind of transfixed by this kind of quite ghoulish event. They're regularly reporting on what's happening, and they're by and large sympathetic to the lone hunger striker and by and large unsympathetic to the government, which is allowing him to starve. So the event is driving further radicalization in Ireland, mobilizing Irish popular opinion further and further against British authority in Ireland, but also it's damaging the British government's capacity to coerce in Ireland. And also the British government is also conscious of how it looks to the world. So, you know, this is all round a disaster from the British government's point of view.
Could anyone have seen coming that this policy around prisons would explode and have political consequences, not just for Ireland, but for Britain and its standing in the world?
The British government must have considered this was a possibility when they decided to return to the policy of stop or starve. But both sides, I think, when the hunger strike began, expected the other to back down.
The crisis drags on. Months turn into years. By the first half of 1921, the conflict reaches a bloody climax. The Irish War of Independence, it cost an estimated 1,400 lives, and more than half of them members of the Irish Republican Army. By mid-1921, Britain is facing a political and military stalemate. A truce is called, negotiations begin, and most of Ireland eventually moves towards independence. But we come back to those prisons. Instead of suppressing rebellion, imprisonment repeatedly intensified it. Prisons became places where British authority was tested and failed.
The prisons are absolutely critical to the Irish revolutionary movement. They are sites where martyrs were created. They were sites where people conducted practical revolutionary activity. They were sites that ordinary people could mobilise around and demonstrate their support for the movement. And they facilitated the prisoners in cooperating and organizing and familiarizing themselves with each other. Sometimes they're described as universities of revolution. So they're absolutely essential to the movement as it happened. But they're also very important to the story of the revolution as how it's told. People like Ash and McSweeney really emerge as some of the key heroes of the revolutionary movement.
Dr. Will Murphy is a professor of modern Irish history at Dublin City University. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf, and the sound engineer was Angie Grant. No One Saw It Coming is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. Before you go, can I ask you a favour? If you're enjoying this brand new episode, make sure you share it around. And of course, if you want to get in touch, you want to email us your own ideas, please do. No One Saw It Coming at abc.net.au. I'm Mark Fennell. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. I'll see you then. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.